Les colloques du Collège de France.
Chère Samantha, un grand merci à toi pour cette nouvelle invitation à délivrer des conclusions générales ici au Collège de France. C'est une fois encore un grand honneur et un véritable plaisir. Merci. So, excitement. This is a feeling that lawyers have, as recalled by Professor Wyman, when they face a legal vacuum. If not a legal vacuum, there is at the very least some indeterminacy, or I should rather say many indeterminacies, that arise from the topic of our conference. Such indeterminacies bring intellectual excitement, no doubt. They call for legal imagination, certainly, but first and foremost, they bring responsibility. As for us, academics, they bring the societal responsibility to walk students, policymakers, and laypersons through those indeterminacies and to equip them with the tools needed to grasp them. This is true in general, but I think that this is particularly true for our topic, as there is much at stake here. So, all the speakers yesterday, today, have brilliantly risen for this challenge and shed light on the many issues that arise from poverty in outer space, looking at them through the lenses of public international law, private international law, and philosophy. They have unraveled and explained the disagreements that exist, for instance, as regards whether or not the Outer Space Treaty prohibits the private appropriation of space resources, or explain the various views about the common heritage of humankind, be it as regards its content or how it should be characterized, either as a principle of international law or merely as a concept. They have also discussed various analogies that can be made with current and past international regimes to help us bringing clarity and thinking about governance. They discuss regimes like the one applicable to Antarctica and the deep seabed. From a philosophical point of view, they have also detailed, for instance, the conflicting moral considerations that underpin the discussion about the appropriation of space resources and the moral justifications that can lead the law one way or the other. So, for those of you who could not attend the conference, and not all of it, you can see that we had very rich and dense discussions. Now, to endeavor myself to rise to the challenge and to perform the task that Samantha kindly asked me to do, I do not intend to recap and to analyze those indeterminacies and disagreements anew. Instead, taking one step back, I would like to emphasize and discuss the key aspects which, in my view, characterize property in outer claims. In line with the unique interdisciplinary nature of the conference that you designed, Samantha, I will do so successively from a twofold perspective, legal and philosophical. Of course, although I will discuss those legal and philosophical considerations in turn, they are very much intertwined. In particular, as the law can be seen as the embodiment of philosophical theories and choices made by policymakers and judges. Also, walking you through these legal and philosophical considerations, I will address key societal issues and development. In particular, the role of science and technology, the importance of culture, the empowerment of private corporations, and more generally, geopolitical developments. So, to pave the way for the discussion of legal considerations, first I would like to start with two preliminary remarks, one methodological, one substantive. First of all, to address those legal considerations, I will not strictly distinguish between public international law and private international law. Why? Simply because in property and space matters, like in many other matters, the distinction between those two bodies of law and disciplines is often blurred. And also because, in any event, they appear very much intertwined here, as shown by Professor Mills in his paper and presentation. Secondly, my second remark, I believe that we cannot discuss outer space resources in general when addressing property matters and how to regulate them. As explained by Professor Wyman in relation to McDougall's work, distinctions must be made. This led her to distinguish spatial extension resources, floor resources, and stock resources. As far as I am concerned, today I would like to focus here on space resources defined as, I quote, extractable and or recoverable abiotic resource in situ in outer space, like platinum or iridium, for instance. So this definition, you can find it in the 2019 building blocks for the development of an international framework on space resource activities. For the sake of clarity, I will simply refer in my remarks to space resources. More specifically, I will focus on the appropriation of space resources by private corporations, even though, as discussed yesterday, other types of ownership, such as public appropriation, are relevant. For instance, if you think about China. So, those two preliminary remarks being made, let's jump into the box. Here, there are three legal considerations that I would like to address, which in my view are really key to discuss our topic. So first, the nature of the claim such an appropriation consists of. Second, the role and status of private corporations in outer space and the regulation of their conduct in public international law. And thirdly, to conclude on those legal considerations, I would like to formulate some remarks as regards interpretation and law-making. As illustrated by our discussions yesterday, and as it is embodied in the program, the nature of the claim, the appropriation of space resources consists of, relates to three key notions: property, territory, and jurisdiction. To fine-tune the discussion, I believe this is necessary to distinguish between two aspects. One is the appropriation of space resources as such. Another one is the exploration and the extraction of those resources. So as regards the first aspect, the appropriation of space resources, this amounts, at first glance, to a property claim, as explained by Professor Stills in her paper. More precisely, this property claim is a terrestrial claim and not a celestial one. Why? This is due to the fact that, despite the resources are located above in outer space, we are talking here about property rights, rights that are created and can only be created on Earth unless, in the future, potentially, an autonomous state-like entity in outer space does so or pretends to do so. So the terms of service of Starlink mentioned by Professor Wiener this morning are very relevant in this respect. But in any case, on Earth, depending on whether such rights or licenses originate from an international regime or from domestic law, as it is the case already in some countries, the source of this right will vary. So here I would like to focus on the rights originating from domestic law. So as regards those rights, I would not discard the possibility to link the appropriation of space resources to a sovereignty claim or an exercise of sovereign power. to realize this, let's first remember that sovereignty has a twofold dimension, internal and external, as notably conceptualized by Jean Bodin in Les Six Livres de la République. So, starting with the first dimension, very briefly, it appears that the exercise of the legislative or executive power through which property rights over space resources are created is part of internal sovereignty. This is an exercise of internal sovereignty which has, so to speak, an extraterrestrial effect. In relation to external sovereignty, I would not discard either the possibility to link the appropriation of space resources to sovereignty. To understand this, let's focus on legal justification. On which legal ground can states unilaterally create property rights over resources beyond their jurisdiction? Well, applying the fishing analogy, Professor Mills explains in his paper that the legal justification argumentation could boil down to arguing that a state can authorize spacecraft registered under its flag to acquire property rights over extracted resources through mining. Those rights would be said to be created within its jurisdiction as if they were created through mining in its territory, the spacecraft being considered then as the legal location of that acquisition of title. So what to think of this? As recalled by Professor Aloupi yesterday, it is well accepted in public international law that personal jurisdiction based on nationality rather than territorial jurisdiction is the right legal category to address vessels. But for the sake of the argument, and also in line with the claim made by Professor Obert that a quasi-territorial jurisdiction is at stake in this matter, let's inquire into this argument. So, if we do so, it appears that the notion of the flag state of the spacecraft establishes merely a fictional territorial connection between that state and the resources extracted outside its jurisdiction. If one lifts this fictional veil, then what appears and is left is an effectivity, which, even if it is not intended to embody a claim for an effective authority over part of the territory of a celestial body, it is not alien to a sovereignty claim. Mutatis mutandis, the same conclusion can be reached if we address this effectivity in relation to the nationality of the spacecraft, in relation to personal jurisdiction. In any case, I do think that sovereignty and also territory are relevant categories to reflect on the type of claims the exploration and extraction of space resources consist of. And here I would like to focus on safety zones. So, as you know, safety zones aim primarily at avoiding the harmful interference between space missions that could result from collisions, explosions, or from the dust generated by landing and surface operations. As such, they are akin to the due regard and non-harmful interference principles. That being said, some of the potential features of safety zones beg the question of whether they do not actually, de facto, embody a territorial and a sovereignty claim over parts of celestial bodies. There are two key elements here to address this question. First, the duration of safety zones. Second, the extent to which those zones can lead to forbid access to others. So, as long as safety zone is reasonably temporary, it is fair to say that it does not amount to such claims. In that regard, it is worth noting that both the Artemis Accords and the building blocks I have mentioned earlier, which both incorporate safety zones, insist on their temporary nature. As regards access, on the other hand, both instruments, even though they stress that safety zones must not impede free access to the areas, each of them, in their own way, acknowledge that the access to the areas may not be completely free as long as there is a safety zone. So, about the Artemis Accords first. So, those accords provide that the signatories commit to respecting reasonable safety zones to avoid harmful interference with operations under the accords, including by providing prior notification to and coordinating with each other before conducting operations in safety zone. But one step further, the building blocks foresee the possibility that the state may restrict access for a limited period of time, provided that timely public notice is given that sets out the reason for such a restriction. So, as it appears, depending on the design and features of safety zones, and also, very importantly, depending on how they will be implemented in real life, miles away from Earth, such safety zones may, at least de facto, amount to territorial and sovereignty claims over parts of celestial bodies. So let's move on now to the second legal consideration, which is about the role and status of private corporations in outer space and the regulation of their conduct under public international law. I will be more concise here. So many have already described the mismatch, to say the least, between space law treaties and recent developments in outer space, be it as regards the new type of operations taking place there, for instance, space tourism, or be it as regards the new actors involved in such operations. Concerning those actors' recent developments and the new reality that they are shaping must be taken very seriously. This reality is well illustrated by the 2021 economic report submitted to the United States, which is reported in Professor Feichner's paper. It says that NASA is changing its role from owner and operator to customer, and also that the agency is acting less as a supervisor than as a partner in public-private partnerships. Well, one could even wonder whether the role of private corporations in a near future will not be more akin in some situations to leadership rather than partnership. So, in such a context, and without even talking about the risk of a flag of convenience mentioned by Professor Moore that may lead to a race to the bottom, how can we seriously expect in this new reality, states to perform their supervision task and to comply with their obligation under Article 6 of the Outer Space Treaty. This begs fundamentally the question of the regulation of private corporations under public international law. Changes as regards both primary rules and secondary rules are likely needed. So, for instance, substantive obligations could be placed directly upon them, for instance, in environmental matters. In addition to, or instead of enlarging the responsibility of states, as you propose, Professor Hober, in your paper, it may be adequate to make them directly responsible for their own conduct. Also, it may be appropriate to establish shared responsibility between those corporations and states when a public-private partnership is at stake. So, obviously, such a move is quite unlikely in the current geopolitical context, which leads me to conclude on the legal considerations by addressing issues of interpretation and lawmaking. So, here again, several aspects. I would like to briefly tackle a few of them. And I would like to do so first focusing on public international law and then on private law. So first, I would like to make a preliminary remark concerning public international law in relation to interpretation and the principle of systemic integration, something that Professor Bayos touched upon yesterday. So I am, maybe because I'm a public international lawyer, I must confess, I'm struck by the fact that sometimes, often, space law is considered, or seems to be considered, to use the word of the WTO appellate body, in clinical isolation from general international law and from other international law regimes. Yet, this is, if you allow me this metaphor, space law is a planet which belongs to a universe, public international law. And there are techniques, in particular Article 31.3c of the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties, to connect those planets, in particular the outer space treaties, with other treaties and customary international rules and principles. So, putting this aside for the time being, it is fair to say that recent initiatives undertaken by some states constitute another illustration that public international law is often a tool that states use, among other tools, to support their foreign policy and interests. So Guy de la Chaya was definitely right in this respect. So in that sense, as mentioned by Professor Byers, the ongoing game of strategies, statements, actions, reaction is fundamentally how international rules have always been made and changed. This is true here, irrespective of how we characterize current efforts to reach a consensus on the legality of the private appropriation of space resources, either as a matter of interpretation or as a matter of customary international law. Also, there is nothing new in the move away from treaties as a way to develop space law, as noted by Professor Achilleas yesterday in his contribution. That being said, there seems to be some features which single out that game strategy among others. So first, as noted by Professor Byers, statement made by some states, in particular NASA officials, illustrate the quite unique transparency displayed by some states regarding the objective that they intend to achieve. Transparency tends here to replace the confidentiality which has long characterized diplomatic efforts. Second of all, and mainly, unilateralism, as it is embodied in domestic law, seems quite unique. Private law as a form of state practice playing an important role in that strategy. Here we have a bottom-up rationale which replaces the top-down approach which has traditionally characterized space lawmaking. So this leads me to my second set of remarks about private lawmaking. The rise of unilateral domestic legislation legalizing the private appropriation of space resources has many implications. So first, obviously, this trend leads to a privatization of space law. Second, because corporation can, so to speak, form shop, this privatization has the potential to trigger a race to the bottom between states willing to attract those corporations and FDI flows. This can only have but an adverse impact on the protection of the environment, notably, as an increasing number of states may be tempted to relax the conditions set out to grant licenses. So linked to this, Professor Rasmussen notes in its paper that making the competition between national legal systems possible is already a form of commoning outer space. Well, it might be in a certain way, but the very least to say about that is that This is not a type of commoning, which is in line with the spirit of the common heritage of humankind, discussed by Professor Tranchetti, whatever content one gives to the notion. In this respect, and conclude my remarks on legal considerations, I would like to stress that private international law may be the strongest limit to private law here. Why? Because property rights granted in one state under its private law may not be recognized in another state under its private international law regimes on public policy grounds. So, second part, I'm so French, sorry about that, but I did an effort and there are not two subparts in my two parts. So, second part on the philosophical considerations. So, let's move on now and discuss those considerations, which again I think are really crucial in our discussion. So, as we have heard during those 2 days, there exist various policy options which are contemplated or which have already been implemented to regulate property issues in outer space. Here, I would like to shed some light on those policy options by looking into two intertwined philosophical issues which, in my view, underpin those options and the debate there. So, the first one is relational in nature. It pertains to the relations that exist between various stakeholders and to how to take into account their respective values and or interest. The second issue is, so to speak, metaphysical. It is about one's own conception of outer space. So let's start with the relational perspective. So we have heard during those 2 days that various stakeholders are, in one way or the other, involved, have an interest in whether or not outer space should be appropriated, and if so, how it should be appropriated. Here it is worth stressing that their interests do not exist in a vacuum. Obviously, they are relational in nature as they interact with one another, either because they support each other or, on the contrary, because they come as a limit to each other. So here I would like to focus on those relationships that raise issues, mainly because they display tensions and conflicts. So those relationships are mainly between private corporations and society, spacefaring nations and non-spacefaring nations, spacefaring nations and communities, notably indigenous communities, current generation and future generations, and also, as pointed out by Professor Wiener, humankind and other species on celestial bodies, if they exist. Another aspect akin to this relational perspective is the relation between humankind and outer space as such, whether or not it is inhabited by species. Obviously, the relevance and even the very existence of this relation depends on how one conceives of outer space, in particular, a non-inhabited outer space. Also, it begs the question of standing and representation. Who on Earth could legally and mainly legitimately speak on behalf of outer space? This is an issue that, as mutatis mutandis, arisen in environmental law and human rights law as regards, for instance, those rivers or lakes which have been granted a legal personality. So it's not a new issue. I will get back to this further in relation to the metaphysical perspective. So, to address the relations I have mentioned, in which the interests of each come as a limit to the other, a balance has to be struck. Choices have to be made. So, to do so for that purpose, we rely on moral principles and justification. And this is even needed if we think of the matter under a law and economics approach in terms of cost and benefits analysis, as ultimately it's required to define the cost and the benefits and to balance between them. So moral principles and justification are necessary to achieve this, even under a law and economics approach. So in their papers, Professor Stills and Moore provided a very thorough examination of those relevant moral principles and justification, and they sketched in which policy and legal direction they lead us. But irrespective of the current crisis of multilateralism, the problem and the main issue is how to arbitrate between those moral principles and justification on the global stage. This is fundamentally a decision-making issue and a challenge which are close to the research conducted by Professor Besson on democracy. So as time is flying, I will not delve into this right now. I will rather directly address the metaphysical issue which I am convinced has a direct implication on the regulation of property matters in outer space. So this issue boils down to one's own conception of outer space. And looking at the discourses and narratives about outer space in policy and academic circles, three such conceptions can be identified, in my view. Outer space as an object, outer space as culture, and outer space as alterity. So let's go through them quickly. So the first conception, outer space as an object, derived from a metaphysics inherited from the Enlightenment, Descartes, notably. This metaphysics distinguishes humankind from nature, humans considered as subjects, having as a project to become the master and the owner of nature, which is conceived here as an object, as a thing. This empowerment of the subject, the chosification of nature, has had profound societal and legal consequences, in particular as regards property matters on Earth. So, unsurprisingly, the same causes provoking the same effects, even in outer space, such a metaphysics opened the doors widely to the private appropriation of outer space. Second conception, outer space as culture, it is based on the societal status of outer space and the role it has always played and still plays in the culture and imagination of communities. So this is well illustrated by the Yolnu practice with Sky Country, which is discussed by Professor Feichner in her paper. Such a conception is also linked to the approach adopted by Professor Massimi this morning in relation to the human right to participate in the cultural life of one's own community. Outer space as culture invites policymakers to take into account the diversity of relations that link outer space to communities and more generally to humankind. Such a metaphysics tends to close the doors, or at least to limit the private appropriation of outer space. Finally, third conception, outer space as alterity. So, this conception leads us away, in my view, not only from the private appropriation of outer space, but also, to some extent, from the conception of outer space as the common heritage of humankind, or as the province of all humankind, which are anthropocentric and earth-centric in nature. Under this conception of outer space as alterity, in particular if there exist other species on celestial bodies, outer space is and will remain outside the reach of any type of human claim. So, to conclude on those philosophical considerations, I would like to briefly link this discussion to the role of science. Indeed, I do believe that one's own conception of outer space has a direct impact on the role that one assigns to science. So, should you conceive of outer space as an object, you will consider science as a tool to master and to exploit it. On the other hand, should you conceive of outer space as culture or as alterity, you will consider science as a tool to understand and learn about it. So, after those few philosophical remarks, I would like the conclusion to put back my thought firmly on the ground, on celestial ground. So, whether we like it or not, whether we find it legally or morally justified, the appropriation of outer space is on its way, and it seems irreversible. So, to avoid that outer space then becomes a new Wild West, a normative framework pertaining to governments, conduct, responsibility, dispute prevention and settlement must be developed to set clear rules for all the stakeholders who are and who will be involved in this appropriation, notably all those people who will be on a mission up there. This appears all the more necessary when one takes seriously into account the fact that this new West is further away than any area ever explored by human beings. Even though those people will be in contact with Earth when no technical problem occurs, this means that physically and psychologically, they will be on their own to apply decisions made here and to take decisions themselves. So, in such a huis clos, there is a high risk for unmanageable drama. It is therefore crucial and even vital to avoid such risk by adopting an anticipative approach to the regulation of the appropriation of outer space, or in any case, to catch the train of the new space. What's more, for any such regulation to actually prove efficient, it must be endorsed by a large number of states, including competing spacefaring nations. Such a need is well illustrated by the safety zones that I have discussed earlier. Indeed, if a safety zone creates obligation only for two or some states, to the exclusion of important spacefaring nations and their corporations, what to think of the safety that it confers? And what about the risk of overlapping safety zones? So, as it appears, short of a multilateral consensus, the future in outer space will likely consist of tensions, disputes, and conflicts. So, this has been said many times, unfortunately, multilateralism is in crisis, and the years to come will certainly remain characterized by a lack of appetite among states for multilateral initiatives. In this geopolitical context, though, cooperation and the space industry at large may be the best hope that we have. Why? Because obviously, tensions and conflict are harmful to their business. More generally, they need legal stability and certainty to increase their chances to get a return on the massive investment that they need to make now for space activities to expand in the medium and long terms. In this respect, unilateral conferral of property rights are not fully satisfactory for corporations, as as we said, they run the risk that a property title delivered in one state will not be recognized in other on public policy grounds. Therefore, as they did in asking some states to adopt national legislation legalizing the private appropriation of space resources, it would then make sense for them to put pressure on states to adopt a tailor-made multilateral legal framework regulating the appropriation of outer space. This is as much in their interest as it is in the interest of humankind at large.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.